Today at Reader's Corner, Russell Muirhead, co-author of the new book, Ungoverning, The Attack on the Administrative State and the Politics of Chaos. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Democracy depends on a government empowered to govern through administration. This administrative state is made up of the vast array of departments and agencies that conduct the essential business of government, from national defense and disaster response to implementing and enforcing public policies of every kind. In their latest book, Ungoverning, The Attack on the Administrative State and the Politics of Chaos, political scientist Russell Muirhead and his co-author, Nancy Rosenblum, chronicle the reactionary movement intent on dismantling the administrative state, often criticized as the deep state. They show how ungoverning disables capacities that took generations to build, including the administration of free and fair elections, and how the movement threatens us all, regardless of partisanship or ideological leaning. Russell Muirhead is the Robert Clemens Professor of Democracy and Politics at Dartmouth College. His previous books, also co-authored by Nancy Rosenblum, is A Lot of People Are Saying, The New Conspiracism and the Assault on Democracy. Russell Muirhead, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Hello.
It's great to have you on the show. I can't tell you how important I think your book is for anyone trying to figure out what the next 4 years of American democracy will look like. I strongly recommend this to our listeners. I don't often do that at the beginning of an interview like this. Sometimes I don't even do it at the end of the interview, if the truth be known. But in this particular case, this is just a must read for the moment we live in today. And again, congratulations on that. What I noticed about the book, of course, is that you have this 2024 imprint. You and Nancy Rosenblum wrote this book not knowing what was going to happen in 2024's election, correct?
That is correct. That is correct. Of course, we did not know. And we wrote it because we had a really strong suspicion that Donald Trump was going to win that election. We understood just how much resentment there was over inflation. We understood how hard it was for the Biden administration to really explain the effects of its major legislative victories. And we understood just what a powerful political force Trump and Trumpism are in the United States of America. So we wrote this, obviously not knowing what would happen, but as if Trump was going to win, looking to the type of politics that would unfold in the United States.
And I do understand that this is a book about more than Trump. But of course, it is a book that I don't think would be quite as salient if somebody else had won. Let's put it that way. Russell, let's begin with the title of your book. What is ungoverning? A term that I hope helps us understand what's at stake in this moment.
For all of American history, we've had, parties, different candidates and different parties contesting with each other. And some win and some lose, but all the parties and all the candidates that are in the American story have wanted to govern. Some have wanted to govern in conservative ways. Some have wanted to govern in moderate ways, some have wanted to govern in really progressive ways. And they all, though, want to make the government work for the people. And the disagreement is always about what it would mean to work well. You know, what we're seeing now, and really, this is still a hypothesis, like, let's see if it happens. What we're seeing now is an administration that doesn't want the government to work. They don't want to govern. They want to incapacitate the government. So it's really, startling. At some level, people say, well, don't believe them when they say that. Of course, they don't mean that. But I have to say, they are saying it. Let me give you an example. Kash Patel, he says that his number one aim is to close down the Federal Bureau of Investigation, to shut down the Washington, D.C. office, and convert the building into a museum of the deep state. That's what he's been promising. That's what he's written in his book. That's what he's said in his speeches. And that's the person who's been selected to run the FBI. He wants to kind of destroy the FBI. And that's not governing. We've never seen that before. That's ungoverning. And sorry to carry on, but there are people who run and say, hey, this particular part of government, we should roll that back. The government shouldn't be specifying, exactly what lunches are served on airlines anymore. We should deregulate the airlines and let them compete based on price. We should get rid of the Civil Aeronautics Board. That's something that Ted Kennedy and Jimmy Carter wanted to do and did in the late 1970s. You know, you could always, people who want to govern, they may not want to do everything that's always been done in the past. They may want to stop something. That's not really what I'm hearing from someone like Kash Patel. He's not saying, hey, there's a better way to generate the kind of investigations that we need to enforce the law than the one that we have now. We need a reformed and revamped FBI. He's saying, no, I'm going to shut down the building and convert it into a museum of the deep state. And we, you know, also have people saying we're going to, our goal is to incapacitate the Internal Revenue Service. And again, that's not tax reform. That's not saying, hey, you know, we should have a what, like a, I don't know, value-added tax instead of an income tax or something like that. Mm-hmm. We should change the way we collect taxes, change, we need tax reform. They're not saying that. They're saying we're going to shut down the IRS. We're going to incapacitate the government's ability to raise revenue. Well, I don't know. How do you fund the Pentagon after you shut down the IRS? I mean, this isn't governing. Mm-hmm. And so that's why Nancy Rosenblum, my co-author, and I came up with this word, ungoverning. It's a kind of, that's what we want to do. We want to, you know, this administration wants to ungovern. It wants to dismantle the institutions that are responsible for making the government work.
You tell the reader that there are, this is a tale of two conflicts behind ungoverning. First, the substitution of personal rule for governing, and then, of course, a reactionary counterculture movement. Help us understand the way that works on the ungoverning that we seem to have arrived at today.
Yeah, that's such a great thing to bring up. I mean, why would any party or person or administration, you know, why would they want to ungovern? Somebody like Donald Trump, he has policy goals. He wants, you know, a certain kind of immigration regime or border policy. He wants tariff policy. He wants a deportation policy. You need a lot of people who are working together pretty efficiently and pretty effectively to, you know, plan, write out, and implement comprehensive policies like that. So why would he want to ungovern? Well, the answer is that this is somebody who can't bear to confer authority on other people. You know, if you work at any kind of scale, let's say I teach a class of 500 people instead of 5 people, I'm going to need a lot of helpers. And in order for those helpers to administer the class effectively, I have to give them authority. I have to say, you're responsible for setting the due date or collecting the papers or something like that. And so that's what it means to administer, to be an administrator. You're delegating authority to other people who are doing your bidding. That's what it means to govern. And when you do that, you give up some personal control. You give up a lot of personal control. And I think, you know, Donald Trump wants personal control. For him, governing isn't about administration, empowering other people to help him, you know, achieve his policy goals. Governing is about him dictating his will to others, making his personal will the law, and that's personal rule. And collecting power in one person means that you can't really administer anything. That's one part of the story, this growth of personal rule. And the other is, you know, it's not just one person. It's not just Donald Trump. You know, Donald Trump is an amazing political force, but, you know, he's part and he's taken over and redefined an entire political party, and he's created a movement. And that movement consists of, you know, many millions of people that we refer to as a kind of reactionary counterculture. They really don't like the culture, not just the culture of government, but in a sense, the dominant culture of the United States of America. And so it's a counterculture, but it's a reactionary counterculture that wants to create an America that's much more like a Christian nation than the America that we have right now. First step has to be destroying the institutions that we've inherited, you know, really making a mess. And out of that chaos and out of that destruction, then you might be able to create something that actually, you know, isn't very popular at all, a very reactionary image of the United States of America.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Russell Muirhead, author of the new book, Ungoverning, The Attack on the Administrative State and the Politics of Chaos. And in those agencies of the federal government that they're going to go after, and I might add, we're talking also about Elon Musk and his Department of Government Efficiency, there's this element of the attack on expertise that you address in your book, and also the attack on process. Again, help our listeners understand how important it is when you're trying to run a government that you've got somebody somewhere that knows the details, you know, the process.
Yeah, that's right. And those are kind of, you know, a process, that kind of sort of just on its face, sort of a boring word. Expertise, you know, who likes an expert? I guess when you need one, when you go to the doctor, you hope you're in the presence of a real expert.
Right.
But there's something about experts that, you know, it conveys a kind of arrogance. But yeah, just to go back to like ordinary examples, I mean, let's say I have a lawn mowing business and I want to expand it, you know, instead of doing 30 lawns, I want to do 300 lawns. Well, I'm going to need to hire some people. I'm going to need to hire some people to operate the equipment, to sharpen the blades, to do some scheduling, to drive stuff around, to do payroll. I'm not going to be able to do it all myself. And so I'm going to have to empower people around me to do some of the tasks that need to be done in order to run a larger scale lawn mowing business. I'm going to have to become more of an administrator. And I'm going to have to hire people who know what they're doing. The people who are running the machines have to be expert running those machines, or they'll just make a big mess of everything. Sharpening a lawnmower blade takes some experience. Let me tell you, somebody who's destroyed a lot of lawnmower blades in his life, I now bring them into the store and pay the expert to do it. And so, you know, there are all kinds of situations where if you just need to replace the brakes in your car, you're going to consult an expert. And you want to talk to somebody, you want to, you know, pay somebody who does this all the time and has acquired a lot of subject-specific knowledge and knacks, you know, understandings that help them get the job done well. This is, you know, obviously true if you want to apply policies to a country that's, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of miles, thousands of square miles, and hundreds of millions of people. You need to look for people who know what they're doing. If you want to, you know, defend this country against enemies across the world, you need experts in the Department of Defense, so many experts in so many different ways. And the other thing you need is you can't just create fiefdoms where individual experts or individual people exercise personal power, unaccountable personal power. You have to have processes of decision making. And it's those processes that allow us, that give us confidence that things are going to be done fairly and in ways that can withstand scrutiny. So government requires process. I mean, it's very frustrating. Process, standard operating procedures are kind of the definition of a frustrating, you know, bureaucracy that can't just bend its rules, even when it seems to make sense to bend the rules. Nope, they have to stick to the process. But the upside of sticking to a process is fairness, predictability, impartiality. The upside of engaging experts is you have people doing things in specialized tasks who know what they're doing. And to get, you know, good results out of a government, you need these two things, process and experts. And they're two things that Donald Trump's very, very, and, you know, people around him, extremely impatient with. They, in fact, his whole promise is, I alone can fix it. It's the promise of a strong man. It's the promise of, you know, kind of Elon Musk style CEO. I'm going to come in there and I'm going to, you know, bang people's heads together and make stuff happen that can't happen any other way. I'm going to will it. And there's this idea, I think this real alluring idea of a strongman who rides in on his white horse or flies in on his private jet and fixes everything, gets rid of the experts, gets rid of the civil servants, gets rid of the standard operating position, you know, processes, and just imposes the right answer and makes it happen. Anyone who's ever been frustrated, I guess, just, I don't know, standing in line in a government office might feel like that's an attractive thing. Everyone's been frustrated just watching the government try to fight inflation, you know, might think that's the right way to do it. But, you know, boy, we need experts in places like the Federal Reserve if we're going to run an economy of the scale and prosperity of the United States economy.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned the Federal Reserve because it falls under that category of federal departments. They're not cabinet appointments. They're independent agencies. You can share with our listeners just what that means, but obviously they're intended to be somewhat independent of any one president or any one party. And along the way, there has developed what you help the readers understand is a unitary executive doctrine. And from what I've heard from President Trump and some of those around him, it sure sounds like they're taking a look at some of these so-called independent agencies, perhaps with the intention of implementing the unitary executive doctrine. Tell us what that is and what you think is going to happen next.
Oh, man, that's such a, I, I wish you were in my class. I really appreciate that. I mean, you take like eighth grade civics and you learn about the American government. You learn, there's a legislature and there's a House of Representatives and there's a Senate, and that's like 535 people. You learn that there's, a president, that's one person, a cabinet, he's got 15 cabinet secretaries. You learn there's a Supreme Court, nine justices. We can get all those people, inside the United States Capitol building for a State of Union address and kind of, see them all in one glance. And that's the government. But in fact, as you mentioned, in the 20th century, it was decided that we needed a new kind of institution, a kind of more independent regulatory agency in different areas, and especially in areas having to do with the economy, in order to manage an economy of the kind of scale that was developing in the United States of America. And some of the things, some examples, the FDIC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the EPA. And these are independent. They're not cabinet departments. They're not directly answerable to the president, who appoints the single leader of the agency. They're usually like commissions and multi-member. They're led by multi-member boards who are appointed. One president only appoints part of the board. So they're sort of independent of the president. Everyone can't be removed by Congress. So they're somewhat independent of Congress. And sometimes their decisions aren't directly reviewable by a court. So it seems like they literally are independent of the other three branches in to some extent. And this offends those who take the first sentence of Article 2 in a really extreme way. The first sentence of Article 2 of the Constitution says the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States, a president, one person. And from that sentence, they say all the executive power has to be in one person. So if any of these agencies can be said to, exercise any executive power, then they violate Article 2, this unitary kind of vesting of all executive power in one person. And I think these are the court too is getting very hostile to these kinds of institutions and is rewriting the writ of authority that they've enjoyed over since the 1930s, since the late 1930s. And there are some people in the United States Supreme Court who I think would like to eradicate. And what they want to do is politicize them. They want partisan politicians, the president and the party, the elected, the people around him, to completely control the FDIC, so that we have partisan politicians setting interest rates, partisan politicians deciding who the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, investigates. So maybe they want partisan politicians in charge of the FBI, so they can decide who the FBI investigates and who it decides not to investigate. And if politics means, rewarding your friends and harming your enemies, then you want total control over these very powerful institutions. If politics means serving the common good, then it's not good to vest total control in one elected partisan politician.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Russell Muirhead, author of the new book, Ungoverning: The Attack on the Administrative State and the Politics of Chaos. You share a couple of examples from the Center of Disease Control and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Associations to help the reader understand when and how personal rule is substituted for the expertise of these agencies you're talking about. You want to just kind of quickly summarize that for us?
I mean, it was kind of interesting in Trump's first term, I believe. And I think we tell the story in the book. I can't remember the details perfectly right now, but he stepped in to kind of redraw the path of a hurricane. He couldn't bear the NOAA scientists having, just speaking from expertise about exactly the path that a hurricane could take. And he kind of redrew it and insisted that he alone, again, he couldn't bear the idea that some little pointy-headed scientist would have the authority to speak about something that he didn't have the authority to speak on. So he inserted himself. And of course, there's that famous moment in the middle of COVID when his own coronavirus response coordinator is speaking, giving a press conference and sharing some, basically recent news and update about the fight against the pandemic. And Trump is there listening to her, and he interrupts and steps in and says, suggests other techniques for fighting the virus, such as injecting bleach under the skin, or maybe irradiating people. And it's absurd, it's laughable, except that he wasn't laughing. He said, I may not be in that moment, I think he said, I may not be a doctor, but I have a good you-know-what, pointing to his head. And this is an excellent example of how just temperamentally he couldn't bear to be in the vicinity of someone who had an authority he didn't have, that he lacked. And what it means to be with an expert is that they have a kind of authority, at least with respect to just saying stuff, speaking, describing, predicting, that non-experts don't have. You know, the radiologist can tell you what the x-ray means more than someone who's never been trained in radiology. They have that authority. A CDC expert has some authority over, you know, the best way to treat the best public health measures, some authority that people who've never studied public health don't have. And NOAA scientist has some authority over predicting the likely path of a hurricane, that someone who's never studied meteorology. And Trump can't bear to be in the room with somebody who has more authority than him. It's an offense to his power, to his standing. So he has to demote them, insult them, humiliate them, and insert himself over and above them. And those are just some, you know, extreme moments, almost so extreme that they're absurd. They're like off a Saturday Night Live skit. They would be, except that they did happen.
And this isn't just a matter of ungoverning at the federal level. You and your co-author, Nancy Rosenblum, talk about partisan federalism. What propels partisan federalism? First of all, I guess, what is it?
Federalism is this amazing system we have where, you know, we have more than one kind of independent political government that we participate in simultaneously. We have the states and we have the federal government. And the states aren't just, you know, agencies of the federal government. They have their own independent standing and they can tax and spend and regulate all on their own. And that, you know, that's federalism. And it used to be said that back in, gosh, you know, the 1980s, the Speaker of the House, this kind of Tip O'Neill, person of the streets from North Cambridge, and his saying was, all politics is local. Like, politics means helping actual concrete human beings with the needs that they have, like finding a job or fixing a problem on the street. All politics is local. Well, right now, all politics is national. State politics has become subsumed by the national party agendas. And the things that are motivating the national parties, the issues, the ideas, the problems, they're also now totally defining our state parties. And so our state parties are just becoming agents of the national party feeling. And that's what's called partisan federalism. Federalism is being swallowed up by partisanship. All politics is national. And states with, you know, Republican trifecta governments, meaning Republican governor, state Senate, state House of Representatives, they're just becoming agents of the Republican president, if there is a Republican president. So that's where the sort of ungoverning agenda of this administration, I think, is going to get picked up and carried into the states through these sort of, you know, large number of Republican trifecta states. Now, of course, on the other side, we have Democratic trifecta states. A large number of states now are trifecta. Fewer and fewer states are split. We're split party control of one or another branch of government. You know, the so-called blue states are going to also be defined by resisting ungoverning. And the federal government's going to attack their efforts to resist. And one place we see that is the attack on sanctuary cities, where these are, you know, efforts by cities and states to protect the basic rights of migrants, even ones who are in the country illegally. And that, you know, effort is going to be under attack from the national government. So there's a way in which the whole energy of ungoverning moves to the states through the way that our partisanship today, our polarization, has just swallowed up our state politics.
You talk about an allied judicial effort. If you could touch on how that reins in administrative authority.
Yeah, I mean, there's. I think you may have caught headlines just over the past, you know, gosh, year about, you know, the rollback of something called the Chevron Doctrine. But it was a doctrine of longstanding, a legal doctrine that came out of the Supreme Court that allowed agencies to interpret laws in reasonable ways according to their own expertise. without being reviewed by courts, without necessarily, you know, being vulnerable to being sued. That's been rolled back so that now agencies, even when they reasonably interpret kind of vague instructions from Congress, they could be sued. And they are going to be sued. And it basically means that powerful moneyed interests are going to be suing our agencies and departments of the federal government. Anytime they do something that's going to cost money for a business, they're going to get sued. And they're going to have to defend their interpretation of a law, an interpretation that they you know, put in the form of regulation. They're going to have to defend it in very, very expensive and time-consuming ways in courts. And so now judges are going to be the ones who decide how to interpret some of the more vague instructions coming from the legislature rather than experts in agencies. And it's going to be somebody. So we're conferring power on judges instead of agencies. And that's a weakening of expertise, a weakening of agencies. And what I can't really tell is whether the Supreme Court, you know, which is of course just 9 individuals, but whether there will be a majority in the Supreme Court that wants to eliminate and destroy the independent agency, the kind of thing that, as we pointed out earlier, the Federal Deposit, you know, the FDIC is, or the Federal Reserve is. Do they want to eliminate or destroy these things? Or are they just rewriting the very, you know, fine boundaries that decide when judges can step in and interpret what agencies do? And I think there are at least 2 and maybe 3 judges on the Supreme Court right now who want to completely destroy administrative power. And depending on how our appointments go, we could see that happen.
So your conclusion is really interesting. You talk about the public mind and how important it is for us to get its attention. Maybe you should share with us, finally, what is the public mind and how we go about that?
Ah, I am just loving your questions. Thank you so much. And I really love that because the public mind is not public opinion. Public opinion is this thing that, you know, pollsters are constantly measuring. And, you know, what is public opinion on this, on that? And it's public opinion is changing. It's volatile. It's hard to predict. The public mind is something much, much, much more steady. It's the enduring commitments of the American people. It represents our shared convictions, the convictions that we share in spite of all, in spite of our partisanship, the convictions, and it's the public mind. It's the convictions, for instance, about human freedom and equality that make America what it is. It's not our policies. It's not even our institutions. It's the public mind. It's the popular commitment to bedrock political moral principles. And I think ultimately, you know, we need you know, a public mind that admits the importance of administration, that admits the importance of governing, that accepts that we are not, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 people living in a wilderness, but that we are, you know, almost 400 million people living in an enormously complicated, incredibly prosperous, but incredibly expansive country that needs government. And that, you know, again, we can want, I am a reformer and a critic. I understand, I'm not for the status quo, but I am for government and for governing. And ultimately we need to defend that idea and help our, you know, persuade each other so that it becomes part of the public mind. Without that, I don't think any government can do well, can succeed, or maybe even can last.
And that, my friends, is a fitting conclusion to just a really interesting conversation with Russell Muirhead, who, along with Nancy Rosenblum, wrote Ungoverning, The Attack on the Administrative State and the Politics of Chaos. This is a must read for those of us who care deeply about what happens next. Russell, I'd like to thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. We really look forward to any future work you're willing to do with or without Nancy Rosenblum. This has been a great interview. Thanks so much.
Oh my gosh, it's been a pleasure and an honor. Thank you.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The audio engineer for today's show is James Baker, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.